Good morning, church. There is a play. It came out a few years ago, and ever since I first heard about it, I had been really wanting to see it. And a few weeks ago, it came out on video. It's never come to Hong Kong since it was first released. So when it came out on video, Justine and I were really excited. We got together with some friends to watch it. And the play tells the story of a man who comes from nothing and works his way up in society. He gets himself a good education by working hard. He lands himself a good job. He marries a respectable lady from high society. And then his wife and he have a baby. He gets a top job in the government. It seems like everything will be great for him in life. And then everything starts to fall apart. He has an affair. He pays off the woman's husband to cover it up. His political rivals discover what he's done. And so he publicly announces his affair so that his rivals can't blackmail him. Which, of course, his wife is devastated, first to learn about his infidelity, and second, to have everyone else learn about it as well and look down on her. And she is so hurt, she basically tells him, from this point forward, we're married in name only. We'll live in the same house, but we're sleeping in separate rooms, and leave me alone. She refuses to say a word to him. And as if that wasn't bad enough, the son gets killed in a fight. And this man had a chance to stop the son from going to the fight, but he didn't. And so he partly blames himself for the son's death, and he sees his world crumbling around him. His career is a mess, his marriage is a mess, his family is falling apart. And at this low point, there's a song, because yeah, the play is a musical, and this song talks about how we should have pity on this man because he's going through something unimaginable. And time is slipping away. He sees his life in pieces. He's trying to do all he can to regain some semblance of a relationship with his wife so he doesn't have to go through this pain and sorrow alone. He talks to his wife. He begs her for forgiveness, and still she doesn't respond. And you, as the audience member, know he deserves absolutely nothing, and he knows it too. He recognizes there's absolutely nothing things better. But then something happens. The song calls it a grace too powerful to name. The couple is standing in their garden together, and the wife reaches down and takes his hand and speaks to him for the first time really since learning of the affair. And she lets him know that she is with him and he is not alone. And at that moment, the choir says this simple but powerful line, forgiveness, can you imagine? Forgiveness, can you imagine? And that's the question Jesus is asking us in today's passage. Forgiveness. Can you imagine? And what Jesus is going to show us is that there are multiple factors that can keep us from really imagining forgiveness in our lives. For some of us, we can't imagine forgiveness because we failed so badly we think God could never forgive or accept us. But for some of us, we can't imagine forgiveness because we think we're so good we don't need it. And regardless of which reason is a bigger factor for you, what Jesus is going to show today is that anything that keeps you from God's forgiveness leads to slavery and is spiritually deadly. But once we're willing to accept the forgiveness God offers us, God celebrates and invites all of heaven and earth to celebrate with him. So today we'll be looking at Luke chapter 15. If you haven't read it yet, I encourage you to pause this right now. Go read it and then come back and listen to the rest of the sermon. And what we're going to see today is that God's kingdom is a party and he's inviting you to join. God's kingdom is a party and he's inviting you to join. We're going to have 4 points: lost and out of sight, lost in plain sight, the invitation, and the seeker. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you are a God who celebrates. You're a God of joy, and you invite us to come and be part of that celebration and to experience and live in. We pray that you would speak to us today, that you would help us learn to imagine forgiveness in our lives and then experience this in our lives. So we are back in Luke this week, and today we're going to be looking at one of the most famous parables of Jesus. Now, to catch us up with where we've been the past few weeks, over the past several chapters of Luke, Jesus has been alienating himself more and more from the religious leaders of Israel. He's been warning people, including these religious people, that his judgment is coming. And he's telling them, be ready for it. And they don't really appreciate that because they don't think that they're under God's judgment. Jesus has been ignoring their religious traditions. He's been confronting the pride and selfishness of the lifestyle of these religious leaders. And Luke is just showing us Jesus is on a collision course with these religious leaders. Something's going to happen between them, and it's going to all blow up. And last week, at the end of Luke chapter 14, we saw Jesus teach about the cost of following him. He says, if you want to follow him, you have to be willing to give up everything you have, even your life, to do it. And today, at the start of chapter 15, there's a group of people who has come forward who want to follow Jesus. High demands and all, they want in. But there's a problem. See, the Jewish society of Jesus' day was a good moral society. They valued people who did the right thing and followed the rules. And the people coming to follow Jesus are the immoral outcasts of society. It says in verse 1 of today's passage, some of them are tax collectors. Now, tax collectors were the scum of the earth. They were seen as traitors to their people. They were hated and despised because when a foreign army, the Romans, invaded their nation, rather than fighting for their people, they sold out their own people and supported the enemy so they could get rich. That's part of the people following Jesus, and the rest of them are just put under this umbrella term called sinners, which was sort of a catch-all phrase for the immoral outcasts of the Jewish society in those days. It would have included robbers, deceivers, adulterers, and more. Fair to say, if you're trying to start a widespread movement in a really moral society like Israel in Jesus' day, this isn't the ideal crowd to start with. But these are the people who are responding to Jesus' call, and so Jesus is welcoming them. And the Jewish religious leaders, they see this, and they grumble. And they judge Jesus and the people. And when they do this, Jesus responds by telling them three stories. And all three stories about something or someone who is lost, then found, and then there's a celebration because it was found. The first story is about a lost sheep. The second is about a lost coin. And the third is about a lost son, or, as we'll see, two lost sons. And the third story goes the most in depth. It's the most famous of the three. So that's the one we're going to focus on primarily today. I'll refer back to the sheep and the coin a bit to draw out some key points in this third story, but mainly we're focusing on the story about the lost sons. And one of the big things that this story shows us is that there's more than one way to be lost. The first way is to be lost in the traditional way, lost and out of sight. That's our first point, lost and out of sight. And this story starts in Luke 15, verse 11. Jesus says, a man has two sons. One day, the younger son comes and asks for his inheritance. Now, if you haven't noticed, there's a problem with this request. The problem is the father is still alive. The son is essentially saying to his father, you're dead to me. And I know many Asian cultures have a very strong emphasis on shame and honor. And the world of Jesus was the same way. This was a shameful thing for the son to do. It brought great shame on the father and on the family. In fact, this shame would have gone so deep that some people who have studied this passage say it would have brought so much shame on the father for the son to ask this, that what should happen right here, the son comes and asks for the inheritance, what should happen is the father disowns the son right then and there. But that doesn't happen. No, the father gives him his share of the inheritance. Quick side note, Jesus is telling the story in a way that invites you to put yourself inside the story as one of the characters. He's telling it so the religious leaders and the tax collectors and sinners who are around him will see themselves in the story, and so we'll see ourselves in it. The fact that the father gives the inheritance to the son is a very clear indicator that the character who stands for you isn't the father. Because nobody in Jesus' day would do this. Nobody, no father, would just give his son the inheritance because he feels like it. So when you're looking for yourself in the story, your options are the older son or the younger son, but not the father. Back to the story. Once the son gets the inheritance, he converts it to cash so that it's more portable, and then he leaves town. He runs away to a far-off land and wastes everything his father has worked his whole life to build up. Now, in my Bible, it says that he lives recklessly. This word reckless could also be translated as prodigal or prodigally, which is where the story gets its traditional name, the story of the prodigal son, because prodigal describes his lifestyle in this far-off land. Prodigal means extravagant and wasteful. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's doing all sorts of things that are explicitly immoral. To get a picture of what prodigal living looks like, maybe this would help. There was an ancient city that someone referred to as prodigal once. And you know what the city did to earn the title of being a prodigal city? The wealthy people there used spiced wine to wash their feet instead of water. They were wasteful and extravagant. They spent money on the fanciest and nicest things just because they could. And of course, when you have no source of income like the son, this lifestyle isn't sustainable. And so the son soon runs out of money, and at the same time that he runs out of money, a famine hits the land. Which means he has no more means of providing for himself. And there's just no food. So people who maybe normally would help him aren't willing to because they hardly have enough for themselves. The son is stranded like an orphan with no money and no support network in a far-off land. And he becomes so desperate that he gets a job feeding pigs, which is a big, huge no-no for any self-respecting Jew in those days. And as if feeding the pigs wasn't bad enough, he realizes these pigs are eating better than I am. He becomes jealous of the pigs, wishing that he could eat their food, but he is not allowed to. And he does this day after day until finally he realizes something. Yes, I've forfeited my right to be a son in my family. What I did deserves for me to be disowned. But my father is far more generous ways than my current. So I'll go home and I'll throw myself at my dad's mercy. I won't ask for a place back as a son. I'll just offer to work for him. Take a low salary, but at least it will be enough to live on. It will be better than what I have here. And he turns around and as we'll see, the welcome he actually receives when he arrives home is going to be extravagant beyond his wildest dreams. We'll get there in a few minutes. But before we get there, let's talk about this son for a minute. Because as we look at this son, it's not hard to see that he's lost. Remember, Jesus is telling the story in a way that invites us to see ourselves in it. Obviously, for his original audience, this son parallels the tax collectors and sinners that he is eating. My guess is that he also parallels someone. Maybe you've lived your life running from God. You've sought to get as far away from him. You've chased after pleasure like there's no tomorrow. If you see yourself in this son, I want to ask you, can you imagine forgiveness? Can you imagine forgiveness? As we look at this story, this son couldn't imagine forgiveness, not really. He could imagine some sort of partial forgiveness where the father sort of grudgingly accepts him as an employee, but he couldn't imagine the extravagant forgiveness that was waiting for him when he came home. He didn't know his father. He didn't know that his father delights in showing extravagant, prodigal love to his sons. But as we'll see in the passage, the son, when he goes home, he is welcomed with open arms. So let me ask you, if you see yourself, do you believe God will accept you that way? Maybe you're a Christian, and you still mess up and turn to these ways. You feel like, man, if God knew how bad I've messed up, there's no way he'd welcome me back. That's the point of this story. He wants you to come home again. He's waiting to welcome you. Or maybe you're listening to this and you're not a Christian yet, but you see your life reflected in them. If that's you, what's keeping you from coming home to God's love? Do you think you need to do something to fix yourself or prove your worthiness when you get there? Do you believe the lie that when you get there, he'll accept you grudgingly because he has to, but he won't really want to? Jesus is telling the story for people like you. He's saying that God wants you to come to him. You don't have to fix yourself first. Just stop running and come home to him. But as I mentioned, there's more to the story. There's not just one way to be lost. Just as you can be lost and out of sight, you can also be lost in plain sight. That's point number two. Lost in... See, this younger son goes home, and the father welcomes him. He throws a party to celebrate, but there's another son in the story. It's the older brother. Now, if you're following the story, this guy stands for the religious leaders who are complaining about Jesus. And unlike his little brother, he never left home. The whole time the younger brother was off partying and throwing away the family fortune, this older brother has been at home working hard on the family farm. Parents, I want to ask you, how many of you parents wish you could have a child like this? Before you answer yes to that, let's look a little more deeply at what's happening in the... Like I said, the whole time the younger brother was gone, this older brother, he's been at home. He's been slaving away at the farm. But that's exactly his problem. See, he's a son, but he believes that he's a slave. He's out in the field working when the younger brother arrives home. He, at the end of the day, comes back home and he hears a party. So he asks one of the servants, "What's going on?" And the servant tells him, "Your brother came home. Your dad killed the fattened calf," which was a big deal. The fattened calf was expensive, and it would have fed a ton of people. If you're killing the fattened calf, the entire town will be invited to this party. The father is making a big deal about the fact that this younger son came home. And when the older son learns about it, how does he respond? He's angry. Now, to give us some perspective, how should he respond here? Joy. Jesus clearly wants him to respond with joy. In each of the three stories Jesus tells, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and then this one, the proper response to finding what is lost is joy for the person who found it and for everyone around them. The fact that this son is angry when he should be joyful shows us there's something deeply wrong with his heart. And the father comes out to invite this older son into the party. And their conversation shows us exactly what that problem is. Here's the problem. Just like the younger brother, the older brother only cares about the father's. He is just as focused on getting the father's money as the younger brother is, but he takes a different approach to get it. He doesn't just go and straight up ask for it. He'd never be so bold and insensitive and shameful as to do that. No, he tries to earn it through his hard work. He believes that me slaving away in the field puts dad in my debt. But here is the deep irony of this. See, the younger son, when he realizes how desperate his situation, he goes home and offers to be a slave. But the older son has been at home living as a slave the whole time. The only difference is the older brother is still rich. He never stops to do the math. If my younger brother already got his inheritance and there's only two of us, everything left belongs to me. And he also never stopped to consider the extravagant generosity of his father. The father just gave the younger brother his entire share of the inheritance. There's nothing the older brother could ask for from the father that the father would refuse to give him, but the brother doesn't see this. All he sees when he looks at the father is a slave driver. And because of this, when the younger brother returns and the father throws him a party, the older brother gets angry about it. I heard a poem, it describes him as the sullen one, whose anger is the instrument he tunes from morning on. Isn't that a powerful description of this older brother? The sullen one, whose anger is the instrument from morning on. I feel like that just helps me feel what's going on inside him. You can picture him out in the field, working hard, and with every movement, he's tuning that instrument of anger in his heart, retelling himself the story of the injustices he has suffered in his life. He has a warped view of reality that blinds him to his own heart. It makes him bitter and angry. I mean, watch how he responds to the father. He says to the father, "I never disobeyed your command." While he's standing outside, refusing to listen to the father and join the party. He doesn't see the irony of his situation because he's blind. He complains to the father, "You never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends, but this guy comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." To give context, he's basically saying, "You never gave me cash to have a party at McDonald's with my friends, but then my brother comes home, you book a banquet hall at the Peninsula for everyone you've ever met." And he makes this complaint blind to the fact the father's bank accounts now belong to him. He doesn't need to ask his father for cash. It's all his already. And then he accuses his brother of wasting the family wealth on prostitutes. Which could be true, but we actually have no explicit evidence that this was happening. But this older brother, he's just reciting the narrative that he's worked into his mind. The one that paints the younger brother in the worst light possible so that he can look like a shining angel in comparison. Just like the younger brother, his whole world revolves around him and what he... And when he sees someone unworthy get what's due to him, while he's out in the field slaving away, that's the breaking point. In all three stories Jesus tells, this older brother is the only person among all the friends and neighbors who refuses to celebrate when what's lost is found. And that's because he is also lost. Yeah, externally he's doing all the right things, but he has no love for his family. He has no joy to discover that his brother is doing well. He has no relationship with his father. So parents, let me ask you again, you still want this guy to be your son? See, what Jesus is saying is that you can be lost and out of sight, or you can be lost. And being lost in plain sight is the far more. Because the one who's lost and out of sight knows that he's lost. But the one lost in plain sight typically doesn't realize anything at all. See, this older son can't imagine forgiveness because he doesn't believe he's ever done anything that needs to be forgiven. And again, like I said, Jesus is inviting us to see ourselves in the. So can you see yourself in the older brother? I mean, that's who I identify with in this story. My natural tendency when I forget God's grace is to live this way. I become judgmental and self-righteous. This is a silly example, but it shows my heart. You know, this week, Hong Kong made the law that you need to wear masks outside even when you're running, which, if you don't know, it's a miserable way to run with a mask on, right? But I love to run. I needed to just get out and burn some energy, so I was out running, wearing my mask like a good older son, and as I was running, I saw a bunch of people running without masks on. And you know what happened? I judged them in my heart. I told myself this story that I am a better person than them because I follow the rules and they don't. How about you? Do you see the world through the lens of the older brother? Do you have a self-righteous and judgmental approach to the people around you? Do you have a view of the world that sees God as a cosmic slave driver that looks down on people who can't live up to your moral standard? If you're a Christian, do you welcome all who come to Jesus? Or do you look down on some of them, not quite as worthy of God's love as you? Do you stand outside refusing to come into the party and celebrate the Father's love for failures and mess-ups until you get what you deserve? Or if you're not a Christian and this brother sounds like you, do you look at all the messed up and broken people in the church and think, you know, if there is a God and he lets them into heaven, he has to let me in because I'm so much better than them. If that's you, realize neither son gets into the party because of his merits or accomplishments. The only way for either son to get in is by accepting the father's, which brings us to point three. Now my guess is that all of us have been lost in one or both of these ways at certain times in our lives. Maybe we tend towards one type of lostness more than the other. Maybe we're sort of on a pendulum, swinging back and forth between the two. Maybe we run back to the Father every time we realize we're lost. And maybe we resist running to him because we feel like we have to make things right before he'll accept us again. We resist running back because we can't imagine. Regardless of which son you identify with, and regardless of how you've responded to God in the past, I want you to see something. The Father in this story, the one who stands for God, gives an extravagant image. See, the younger son had brought shame on the family. It was actually dangerous for him to come back home. It's possible that someone, one of the slaves or someone from the town who cared deeply for the father's honor, if he saw the son coming first, he could come to him and send him away, say, stay away, don't bring more shame on your family. Or if he was really extreme, it's possible he could have attacked him to bring judgment on him for what he did to his family. But notice what the father does. The father is watching for him, waiting for his return, which is why he sees him when he's still far off. The father wants to be the first one to be aware when his son gets home so that no one else has a chance to get in his way or keep him from coming to the father. And as soon as the father sees the son, he runs to him and he wraps him in a huge embrace. Now notice a couple things about this. First, an older man in that society did not run. It was undignified. It required lifting up the lower parts of your robes, which revealed a scandalous amount of leg. But the father didn't care about being scandalous. And second, this embrace, yes, that's a sign of welcome, but it's possibly also an act of protection. Because if someone was tempted to attack the son in order to preserve the father's honor, he now has to go through the father to do it, which would sort of defeat the purpose of trying to defend the father's honor. The father runs to his son, gives him an extravagant welcome, and then when the son starts his speech, asking to come back as a slave, the father doesn't let him. He cuts him off before he can get to the part where the son asks to be an employee. And the father calls for the best of what he has to be given to this son. He restores to him the rights and privileges of a son with no questions asked. He throws a party because he's excited to have his son home. His welcome is extravagant. It's prodigal and wasteful in the best way possible. But his extravagance doesn't end there. Because remember, the younger son who's brought shame, the older son also brings shame to the family by refusing to join the party. And just as he went out to the younger son, the father goes out to the older son. Again, this didn't happen in that society. The older son's actions are offensive. He's being disrespectful and rude to his father. He doesn't deserve an extra invitation. In their culture, what many people would say he deserves is a beating. And rather than beat him, the father goes out to him to talk with him and invite him in. And the father puts up with his horrible attitude. Do you notice how the older son starts his speech to the father? He says, "Look!" If you're a parent of teens, you know when your kid starts a conversation this way, it's not going to be a fun conversation. It's not a proper way for a child to address a parent. But rather than scold him, the father patiently explains to the older son why he's throwing and he invites. See, both sons see themselves as slaves who belong outside, and the father comes to each of them to tell them, that's not, you don't belong outside, you belong in the party. You're not a slave, you are a son. You belong with your father. So what does that mean for us? It means no matter which son you're more like, no matter which way you are lost, no matter whether you realize you're lost or not, God invites you. He says you don't belong out. You belong in. You're not a slave. His invitation is extravagant, and it doesn't depend on your worthiness. But there's one more thing we need to discuss, and that's seeker. Point forward. See, I mentioned at the start of the sermon, Jesus tells us three stories in today's passage, and the stories are largely parallels. There's a general storyline that they all follow, but there's one key ingredient in the first two stories that's missing in this one. See, in the first story, the man loses the sheep, goes to look for it, finds it, and celebrates. In the second story, a woman loses a coin, looks for it, finds it, and celebrates. And do you see what's missing in this third story? Who went to look for the missing son? Nobody. Nobody went to look for this missing son. They just wait for him to come home. Which raises the question, should somebody have looked for him? And the answer is, maybe. See, in that culture, there was some level of responsibility that was supposed to fall on the older brother for caring for the rest of the family. And there's debate about how far this responsibility would have extended. Some people say it was his responsibility to chase down the younger brother in a foreign land and bring him home. Some people say it wasn't quite that far, but for sure, it was the older brother's job to mediate between the younger brother and the father when the brother returned. There's a level of proactivity expected of him. You know, maybe something like telling the servants, if you see my brother coming or hear that he's close, tell me so I can get to him first. The attitude that the father had is at least the attitude this older brother should have had based on his role in the family. But clearly, he didn't do this. He was so apathetic about what happened to the younger brother that hours after the younger brother arrived, and everyone from around the neighborhood knew that he was back and was partying, the older brother still had no idea. He didn't care about the younger brother. He was a terrible older brother. And the amazing news of the gospel is that's not. The Bible tells us that Jesus, God's son, older brother, who comes to search for us when we are lost and far from God. And Jesus doesn't just travel to a far country, he leaves heaven to come to earth. God doesn't wait for us to get ourselves sorted out and come to him, he pursues us. But there's more. See, accepting the younger brother back into the family had financial implications for this older brother. And again, there's debate about how big those implications were. Some people say the father, by welcoming the son in this way, is adopting him back into the family. And as an adopted son, he would therefore count as basically a third child who now gets another share of the inheritance. But I think based on verse 31, when the father says, all that's mine is yours to the older brother, that's probably not the case. But even if the younger brother doesn't get a new share of the inheritance, there's still a huge cost for the older brother. Clothes weren't cheap in those days. And when the younger brother got back, the father had a Louis Vuitton robe, a Cartier ring, and Gucci sandals just given to the younger brother. The fattened calf was part of the older brother's inheritance, an expensive part of the older brother's inheritance, and it just got killed for the younger brother's party. And as if that wasn't enough, it was the responsibility of the oldest son to provide for younger siblings who couldn't provide for themselves throughout life. And since the younger brother just wasted his whole inheritance, that means he's going to be financially dependent on the older brother for life. There are going to be costs financially for this older brother for life to take care of his younger brother. And the older brother clearly wants no part in bearing any of it. But Jesus, our perfect older brother, bore a greater cost to make a way for us to join God's party. See, the price of our rebellion against God wasn't financial, it was death. And on the cross, Jesus paid that price joyfully and willingly on our behalf. He paid the price of sin for the younger brothers among us, the ones who have lived our lives in open rebellion against God. And he also paid the price of sin for the older brothers, the ones who have lived good moral lives to try and put God in our debt. Because none of our effort, all of us are lost. And the only way we can get into God's party. So let me ask you again, imagine. I don't know if you noticed this, but this story actually has no ending. We don't know what the older brother decides. The story is left with him and the father talking in the field. We don't know. Will he join the party? Will he stay outside? Will he get angry and run away from home? We don't know. And like I said, Jesus, by telling the story, he's inviting us to see ourselves in it. This story is God's kingdom. He's inviting. So how will you respond? Father, we thank you for your extravagant love. Thank you for Jesus, the perfect older brother, who left the joys of heaven to chase after us and find us when we were lost, to bear the price of our rebellion, and to welcome us back into your. God, help us to trust in you, help us to respond to you, to join the party, to celebrate your love for us, and thank you that you're good to us.